Ladies and gentlemen, fellow slaves of the plantation, welcome to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's Vinnie with a Y because it's the most important question. And Eastwood, like, go ahead, make my news. It's the lighter side of genocide. Just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? The Vinnie Eastwood Show. The only thing worse than the truth is Vinnie's jokes.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode. I'm glad to have you all here, especially when we're running out of coffee and don't have any money for any more. You know, isn't it interesting? My wife's a gardener, right? During the winter, when it rains, her gardening work dries up. Because it gets called off because of the weather. And it makes getting through the weeks very, very difficult when you're an activist relying on donations. So, ladies and gentlemen, please, if you can, need about maybe 30, 40 bucks or something like that just to pay the rent this week. And that's not including the coffee and maybe food we need. So if you are capable of going to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com right now and heading into that KiwiBank, that PayPal, or even signing up to be a regular donor through the PayPal and Patreon pages there, I'd very much appreciate it immediately. Now, my very special guest is Mike Cross. Mike, welcome back to the show. I haven't had you on for a while, mate.
Oh, it's good to be here, Vinny. You're doing a great job out there informing the masses.
Yeah, well, somebody's got to. And, you know, the problem is, I've found, Mike, is that people value their beliefs more than their knowledge. Like, if their knowledge contradicts their belief, they don't change their belief. And that's what's very difficult about sharing knowledge sometimes, is that people's beliefs don't let it in.
In psychology, that's called cognitive dissonance, and you're up against a big foe when it comes to that.
Yes, commonly known in the field as a mofo. Now, speaking of what, we are going to be talking about narcissism and psychopathy today, and I believe I had a series of notes, which I, of course, I forgot to copy and paste to you, bro.
Okay.
Trump being a narcissist. Okay, I just want to start off with this one and by saying that, ladies and gentlemen, there is actually a college professor who changed his class teaching protocols when he was teaching the subject of narcissism to only focus on the traits of Donald Trump. Because in all his years studying into this phenomenon, he'd never seen a more clear-cut case and perfect classical example, as in, like, narcissist incarnate as Donald Trump. And surprisingly, his classes started to get it all of a sudden. Well, I've now recognised this shit. What does a narcissist do? So anyway, I'd like your analysis on that, because we want to compare this, the narcissistic personality of Trump, to the psychopathic personality of Hillary.
Okay. First of all, we have to do that old disclaimer. You know how that works. You know that we're not, you know, we don't have them on the couch and doing an analysis of them and so forth. And so we can only go by their public personas. We can only go by the traits that we see displayed on the outside. So clinically, this is totally up to us to analyze and to just look and see how they behave. But first of all, before I go on, I just have to point out something very interesting. And you ever see the State of the Union address when they have the president and the vice president and the Speaker of the House and all the congressmen and senators in the same room?
Yeah.
That is a support group for narcissists and psychopaths. You've got them all together because, you know, face it. The traits of narcissism and psychopathy, which we can go into in a lot more detail, those are traits that actually lend themselves to being successful in fields like politics. Ironically enough, if you look at psychopathy, some of the fields that psychopaths tend to gravitate to are journalism, chefs, for some strange reason, emergency room doctors, surgeons, clergy, and entertainment. Those are all very, very high in psychopathy, because the traits of psychopaths, and we'll point out that not all narcissists are psychopaths, but all psychopaths are narcissists, okay? There is that overlap. Those traits, you give them to someone, and if they can keep themselves out of jail, they're ready for the corporate boardroom or the prime ministership or presidency or any number of other political offices. And most people, I'll say this, most people that are listening even, except I'm sure your listeners are a lot more informed than the average person, they believe that people all see the world the way they do. You see, this is part of human nature. We see the world, that everyone must think the way we do. And that's not the case. That is absolutely not the case. Both narcissists and psychopaths see the world in totally different ways. Oh, and by the way, what's really dangerous is they see other people as if they're psychopaths and narcissists. That could explain all the surveillance state and all the controls they try to put in, because they think everyone's out to get them. They think the world is a big, giant Game of Thrones situation.
Yeah. That's part of the personality disorder, is a healthy sense of paranoia.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. For both of them. The narcissist believes that people are going to try to ruin their reputation, ruin how wonderful they are. They are the center of the universe. They don't want anyone to spoil that. The psychopath the same way, but they're more driven towards personal power. They don't care as much about how much people think of them, as long as they're still voting for them and so forth. They're not worried if someone says, I don't like you, because they're just like, psh, whatever.
Now, we put down here that the advantage of a narcissist is that they still care what people think of them. You know, you can convince them to change their minds. They can be influenced. But the advantage of a psychopath is that they won't switch back and forth to please a crowd.
Right. I mean, you can think about this. Again, we're only going by public persona, but you can look up terms like Obama/narcissist as well. I mean, his speeches were sort of like, he used the word I, you know, like what, hundreds of times in one speech. I. Again, we don't know because we don't have him on the couch, but, you know, he was someone that always seemed to have his finger to the wind. And if things looked good for him to get votes or financial support, he would switch his policies. He did that on, however you feel about this one way or another, he did that on gay marriage when it looked like he wasn't going to do so well against Mitt Romney. All of a sudden he went, oh, yeah, I'm for gay marriage. Well, okay, well, this was something I don't think he was just sitting back, you know, in bed going, you know, I really think that people have a right to get married regardless. This was all pure politics. And this is how they look at things. Oh, I get more popularity if I do this. So they're switching around a lot. Narcissists will change. If you're in a conversation with a narcissist, they'll change their position over and over and over again. You know, if it looks like this is the winning position to take. So by the end of it, it looks like they're supporting what you supported in the first place. So psychopaths, not so much. They'll convince you you're crazy and go from there.
That's the YouTube effect, I think they call that. Whenever you get a YouTube comment, is basically somebody saying you're nuts, you're crazy, you're not going to be able to do this. And an article came out, I believe, in the Times that narcissists, psychopaths, and it's not masochists. What's the opposite of a masochist? A sadist. Are traditionally the personality profiles of people who engage in online trolling. And it's very obvious. They have this craving for attention. They need it because the brain doesn't develop normally when you're young if you don't get enough love and compassion and comfort from the people who are supposed to be protecting you, essentially. So you'll split it up and it'll become a sort of hyper version of a survival instinct programming the human mind because it does not know that it can trust the people that are next to it. And that's again, as we pointed out earlier, a massive advantage when it comes to getting into competitive fields, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Psychopaths even more so, because they not only are very highly competitive, but they don't follow any rules beyond what they think that they can't be caught for.
Mm-hmm. Now, neither the psychopath or the narcissist really likes to follow rules. Mm-hmm. Because they both feel that they're superior to the rules. But the psychopath, again, they're not accountable to anyone but, well, themselves and their own success. Also, what you say about trolling, I've seen those articles dealing with online trolls tend to be psychopathic. One of the traits of psychopathy is a sense of feeling bored really easy. Now, of course, there's theories as to maybe their brains don't produce as much serotonin, meaning that something that you might be, you know, thrilling for you or me, to them might be very boring. So they have to up it. So yeah, going on a website and causing trouble and flaming and causing big arguments and contention, this is something that I would assume would be very popular with them.
They tend to also be adrenaline junkies, extreme sports stars, yes, and things like that. And so, because the brain's got three layers to it, you've got your neocortex, which is your upper thought functions, and you've also got your mammalian brain, which is a lot of your emotional and how you evaluate things. And then your lower cortex, your reptilian brain, governs that fight or flight. And because psychopaths have more or less the top two layers of the cortex turned off, the only way that they can actually feel stimulation isn't through emotion. It is indeed through physical sensations. So drugs, extreme sports, getting into fights with people. It's the only way they can even feel alive.
Yeah. Now, I wouldn't say that they're dumb. I mean, you know, we got to point out that the cerebral cortex, of course, you usually associate with intelligence. Psychopaths tend to be very high in creativity, but it's because they don't follow convention. So something you might think, if you're an artist and you're thinking of doing some sort of exposition and you've been raised to think, well, maybe this is going over the limits. You shouldn't do this. This is bad taste. The psychopath will not look at that way. They'll think, what will get me more popularity? So they'll take it to the extreme. And of course, in our society, we naturally will say people that do things that are different and innovative must be creative. And so there is a component there. But yes, they are adrenaline junkies. And a lot of times in relationships, you'll hear people that have been in relationships and they become addicted to psychopaths, because they come from a nice, calm background, and then they meet some psychopath who gives them the permission to break all the rules and to do things they never would have thought of. So often they'll break up with a psychopath later when the psychopath gets bored with them, but they'll find another one to replace them because, you know, the other people suddenly become boring to them. So that's why sometimes you'll go on these online sites where people will complain. Often they're talking about ex-husbands or boyfriends, but you'll find that psychopathy, there's a theory that there's as many psychopathic women as there are men. It's just that we tend to diagnose the psychopathic women as borderlines in many cases. And but the thing is, you'll hear these people, they'll say, well, I've been involved in three relationships with psychopaths. Well, you think the first one they would get the point. But no, that they meet someone else and they're just like downright boring. They just want to sit and watch TV for the evening or go out to a nice dinner. They're not into naked bungee jumping or something like the psychopath would be.
I wonder why the film industry is so concerned with the next biggest stunt and the next biggest hoopla of the CG and whatnot. It's almost like there's a limitless potential, right? You think about this concept of if you've got psychopaths in control of the media and people's imaginations to a large degree, in so doing, you're going to influence the imaginations of society at large. Now, that can be... Mm-hmm. What do you think about that? That's cult indoctrination on a mass scale.
Oh, I can't remember his name right offhand. There was a Polish professor who wrote, I think it's called Political Ponderology or something like that.
Yeah, I heard of it.
Where he talks about people will adapt to adapt to environments to succeed. And what happens is many of them become what, you know, some people would refer to as secondary psychopaths, in that they're not born psychopathic. I do contend there is a genetic component. They're not born psychopathic, but they see that the traits of psychopathy get them where they are. There's books out there you can get called, you know, how you essentially what you can learn from psychopaths, you know, and that sort of thing. And what you could get in the society is people see that the characters that display psychopathic tendencies. I think there's a pretty good case to be made that characters such as James Bond are psychopathic. You know, people think, no, not James Bond. He doesn't sit in the basement cutting out pictures of murder victims and something. No, he has a nice suit. He kills someone and he makes a joke about it. And then goes and has sex with five or six different leading ladies, you know, and people think, oh, wow, you know, he's cool. You know, he was the in the 1960s, especially, he was kind of the ultimate playboy icon. And in reality, he's a psychopath. And there are other characters, too, that are presented. I would note that, you know, from the old TV series Dexter, I wouldn't consider him a psychopath. You know, he doesn't have that coolness about him. He doesn't have that manipulation. He's just out to, you know, rid the world of bad guys. Kind of Asperger, really, at least in my opinion, in the way that he goes about stuff. But, it's, you know, let's see, House of Cards. Oh, my gosh. You know, lots of characters to choose from or something like that. But think about the indoctrination people are learning there. Oh, here's how you get ahead in politics. You know, and even though it may have this moral about it, like, oh, this was bad to take place, still, who wins? And this is something that's pushed in the society. And again, you can make someone behave like a psychopath without them being psychopathic. Problem is, you know, later they may have like a post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, thing happen where they still have that guilt complex if they do something wrong.
It's funny you say that because the symptoms of complex post-traumatic stress disorder, which is post-traumatic stress disorder, but it's got an extra layer on top of it because the trauma went on for an extended period of time, whereas post-traumatic mm-hmm. stress can be like one thing that happened to you just boom right then and it didn't mm-hmm. continue for like a month. And it turns out that a lot of the personality traits of people who are suffering with this are actually identical to a lot of narcissistic and psychopathic personality traits as well. Mm-hmm. And there's hundreds of traits, I think, for each of them. And I just noticed when I was looking through these things, oh, my God, there's a similarity there and there and there and there and there. And also the ways that psychopaths and narcissists manipulate people and get them to go along with them and accept their ideas and indoctrinate them and get them mm-hmm. to behave like proto-psychopaths are almost identical to the same methodologies that you see in government mind control institutions and cults yes. that have gone on. So it leads me to believe that not only does most of the institutions, businesses, law, medicine, etc., religion, whatever. These control structures, hierarchical in nature, it seemed to me that they were all created by psychopaths, the very structures of them, in order to benefit themselves and conceal themselves from public view and retribution for the things that they do. Mm-hmm. And
I think that's actually safe to say. And yet at the same time, if we take a look at what attract, let's just say we just took a look at biology, what attracts people biologically to another person. If you take the traits of psychopathy, except for the, you know, the behavioral ones, the ones that manifest themselves in things like, you know, criminality and stuff like that, and you just word it a little differently, you just word it, you know, like, for instance, lack of you know, psychopaths, one of the traits is very, you could say manipulative, but you can also say charming. And you'll find that many people would say, oh, that would be an ideal mate. That would be someone who would be really attractive. We are attracted to them. And actually, studies have shown that psychopaths tend to look younger. They're more attractive, maybe because they don't let themselves go. They exercise. They do all these things. They tend to have a higher level of testosterone, which means they're more competitive. But both for men and women.
It was actually for territory. That was one of the interesting things about the lower reptilian brain, is that it's actually directly responded to our behavior when it comes to defending our territory. And I noticed mm-hmm. that's very interesting when you look at psychopathic behavior. Whenever their territory is getting invaded or something like that, they become incredibly vicious.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They're extreme. They'll get their little, depending on what kind of psychopath you have. I mean, you can have a cerebral psychopath who is more towards the intellect level. I would say a lot of cult leaders are like cerebral psychopaths. If you insult their intelligence in any way, they will destroy you. Then there's others that are motivated by money and power and these kinds of things. Of course, power would also fit in with the cerebral. And they're also both narcissists and psychopaths both do not like to be criticized. They will go after someone who cuts back on them. And so the only thing I did a video recently, I haven't posted it yet, on the advantages and disadvantages of psychopathy. And I was kind of responding. Someone had said, there's a lot of videos out there that say how to get back at a narcissist, how to get revenge on a narcissist. And what I did was I just responded to that. And I said, what if you're making a mistake in your diagnosis? What if the person you're going after is a psychopath? it's kind of like going, I'm going to go hunt this fox that's killing my chickens. And then you find out you're up against a wolf, or something like that.
Or a bear.
Yeah. It's very, very dangerous to do that kind of thing where, okay, they show these traits. I don't like them at work. I'm going to get revenge. Well, you'll be the one with the pink slip, in the end. You'll be the one losing relationships and so forth if that person happens to be a psychopath. Narcissist, maybe if they see that something's not really benefiting them, they may stop or they may quit the job or something like that. But a psychopath will not do that. Psychopath is going to take you down, whether it means they go with you, they go to or not. They will take you down.
That's recklessness. That's another trait there, isn't it? Just this mm-hmm. whoop from 0 to 100 in 1.6 seconds, bringing a bazooka to a knife fight, right?
And absolutely.
The justice principle within people will incorrectly make them assume that because they're in the right, that something is going to happen their way, right? No. If you've got pure scumbaggery, things go your way. That's actually how it works. The more scumbaggery you have, the more likely things are to go your way. And people get taught the exact opposite in life by whom? Psychopaths. So that can very easily be conquered and controlled.
There was an American politician, and he said something about Mitt Romney during the election. He threw it out there, and it got a lot of press. Later, after the election, they asked this politician. They said, that wasn't really true about Mitt Romney. And his response was, oh, well, he didn't get elected, did he? And this is the way – I'm not saying this particular person was a psychopath, but that is the way they think. The ends justify the means at all times. And without that kind of empathy and guilt and those kind of things, they are totally cognitive based. They're not a Mr. Spock. They're not someone that's just, emotionally blank. They can read your emotions way better than the average empathetic person. They just don't feel them. Or if they do feel, they'll have what's called cold empathy. You get your leg cut off at work and they're going to be like, oh, that sucks that happened. But they're not sitting there like, emotionally thinking, oh, my gosh, this is my best friend. He lost his leg and I don't know how, you know, they're not thinking in those terms. They may just be thinking, oh, wow, he lost his leg, and how is this going to affect our annual fishing trip?
Well, that's interesting, because we were at this public meeting once, and these ladies who had vaccine-damaged children who were, like, absolutely crying, right, and they're crying to the politician to you know, to listen to them and that kind of thing, and the politician's like, oh, they're there. And I was just like, oh, my God, that's so creepy, bro. You know, you can just well, see them.
If you've ever been involved in any kind of political activities and stuff, you'll find that once a politician gives this, like, you know, a lot of them, I don't care what party they're in, they'll give some sort of really emotional, heartfelt speech. And then when the crowd leaves and you're just kind of like there, you know, one of the aides or something, and they're just joking around and laughing and, you know, kind of making fun even of the participants. Oh, did you see the lady crying in the third row because she felt emotionally touched by my speech? That's the way they see it. Yeah, it's a game. Life is a big game. Oh, I won the election. Oh, I sold these. My sales have gone up. I've been able to, I don't know if you're a marketer, I've increased the amount of anxiety that young teenage girls feel about their bodies, and now they're buying our product in order to feel better. Yay! You know, that's how they think.
If it's an achievement, you know, it's a, what was it? Government and corporations are essentially psychopathic in nature because they don't value the moral and ethical questions of what they do before or after they do it, more or less. And that's the difficult nature. Like, how do zebras overthrow the rule of the lions?
You know, that reminds me of a movie. Now, I'm not going to say anything about whoever made the movie, and it was sort of based on Hamlet. But if you remember The Lion King, did you ever see that cartoon?
Yeah.
Where it's like an understanding that the zebras and the gazelles and all these animals have that, oh, they're going to eat a few of us, but they're going to not eat all of us. So therefore, yay, and they're out cheering the birth of this new lion cub. And I'm thinking to myself as I'm showing this to my children who were very young at the time, I'm thinking, is this a metaphor for Western society in general? I mean, you're cheering like, oh, right, well, he may eat me later, eat my kid. But, you know, he's better than the darker brother lion over here who's sinister and hangs out with hyenas. You know, I mean, but yeah, I think there is this kind of view that, you know, when you do have the pyramid or the hierarchical system, that we sort of expect this kind of thing at the top.
Well, what's problematic about that is people put their faith in these people. Like, what is it? I don't know. You've probably heard this phrase quite a lot. I hear it all the time in regards to a politician or somebody or an anybody. He's a good man. Oh, he's a good man. You know, I met him. I had a beer with him once. I talked to him when I was 9 years old once. You know, I know everything about them. They couldn't possibly be a narcissistic, psychopathic dictator in disguise who's planning on unhatching in some kind of communist scheme to very slowly and progressively destroy the country and the nation and socially engineer everybody to be subservient slaves. That's just not a possibility. You know, the blanket dismissal that people who are in the full grip of psychopathic influence, that very indoctrinated cultist, is very sad to see. It's like toxoplasmosis. A cat can attract rats and mice who come into contact with its feces because the toxoplasmosis in the shit that they're exposed to will drive them nuts and make them seek out the presence of a cat and get themselves killed. And I was talking about that with the guys who were coming around to clean the chimney the other day, and I go, hey, it's just like politics. You know, the voters smell the shit, and then they come into the fold of the very, very nasty predator creature up there that laid the shit out for them, and then they get exterminated, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and... Well, I mean, you even get this kind of thing when it comes to wars. you know, where people are, you know, they put the blinders on. There has actually been a lot of psychological operations, PSYOPs, where what they've done ever since the days of George Bush, the older one, is that they changed the way that we talk about war. We no longer talk about civilian deaths. We talk about collateral damage. We no longer talk about fighting people even. We talk about engagement. I mean, nice words, engagement. Oh, that sounds like, well, when a boy and a girl meet and they get engaged, it doesn't mean that, oh, a whole bunch of people just died. I mean, we changed the language to fit this kind of idea. It's like, you know, when you have some of these people talk about, oh, we need to have a national draft, you know, to bring more people into the military. And they'll word it in such a way that, well, for instance, Sweden, what they've done, because they're starting to reinstitute like a draft, is they know that, you know, Swedes tend to be very strongly feministic. So they start talking about, we're going to make it fair and equal, and we're going to bring women into this as well. And so Swedes are like, oh, right, yay, you know, it's going to be like a big, you know, statement of feminism. And you're like, well, wait, the government is, you know, just making it to where they get more and more people under their control in that sense. So, you know, regardless of whether you believe in the draft or not, I mean, that ultimately is, I mean, that's the ultimate control when you can say, oh, interrupt your studies, interrupt your life. You're going to come and serve who knows how much time in it with some sort of military training and eventually maybe in service, you know, in wartime. So, you know, you can sell anything. I mean, thinking about Sweden, I was seeing this documentary, well, not really documentaries, but just news stories about microchipping. And they're talking about this one company, you know, that maybe you have a monthly pass, you know, for a transportation service. And they're saying, well, we're experimenting with microchipping. So you put this thing in your hand and it'll be so convenient to be able to just, you know, you want to carry your card and your wallet and that sort of thing. The same with some other companies there, too, that are experimenting with it when it comes to, you know, instead of having to type in a code when you go into the door, you just wave your hand. And I think that actually a lot of people freak out when they hear about microchipping and stuff. But believe me, you could sell it to where people, even the fundamentalist Protestants who believe that this is all part of like a mark of the beast, they'll be lined up around the corner to get their chip.
Well, what's interesting about the mark of the beast thing is in the old Greek, which some of the documents and things of that nature that came into the Bible were translated from, the mark of the beast, the original translation for that mark was actually money created. All right, so mm-hmm. And that was how it would control people. That's how people couldn't buy or sell without it, because it was currency.
Mm-hmm. Right? Well,
so we're already using currency. We've already got the mark of the beast, right? And I thought that was quite interesting, because that means that it's been a very similar dominion. Because currency has been the same more or less since the days when the old goldsmiths started making up fake little receipts and giving it out to people with more money than they had. It's like, boom, there you go. There's your biblical prophecy. It just repeats itself and repeats itself and repeats itself. It's not entirely dissimilar from history, which is why the Kabbalah, which Guy Ritchie and Madonna really, really love, and in fact it's the reason they got together, no kidding, is the concept of predicting the future by looking at what? The past. And it's given rise to the belief, or at least I'm starting to believe, that because Freemasons are both in the churches of Islam and Christianity, that they're simply using this, using prophecy more or less as a playbook. You know, oh, a certain amount of people believe this, they're in our cult, and we'll keep doing this. Oh, how long have we got until we have to do this? Oh, we've got another 319 years to pull that off. Nah, don't worry, mate, we'll let our descendants take care of that. Who knows?
Well, I happen to actually believe, and here's where a plug is going to come in, so beware. I do happen to actually believe that history repeats itself. I really do. And I think that people that are really into maybe esoteric societies, they recognize this too. And so they can see the patterns. Now, whether you want to say, I mean, I know there's a lot of people listening probably believe that there were ancient civilizations. And I don't mean, you know, that they were just like huts and stuff like this, but that they were actually quite advanced. And that there is a history that we're not aware of. That's why, I mean, I wrote a book called The Destiny of Our Past. It's a sci-fi book. You know, people can look it up on Amazon. But I titled it Destiny of Our Past because basically it just says what happened then will happen again. And so I really do believe that people that are more in the know, more that study these kind of things, recognize this. That human, you know, things are not really new. We may have new toys to play with, or maybe we have old toys that we used to have originally, and that, you know, this is how you can use it. You know, so if you look at something like the Book of Jasher, which talks about biotechnology, you know, the thing about, you know, God got angry because the people were crossing species together. And then we look today, well, we have the same thing going on. And here's the fun part. What if we actually... We're talking about psychopaths controlling the world, and look at the technology that's coming along that's going to make it so much easier. I mean, everything. I mean, you'd have to be totally blind not to recognize that nanotech, biotech, artificial intelligence, all of this is going to be – it's a real wonderful blessing if it's used by nice people, but if it's in the hands of bad people – it's the ultimate dystopia.
Well, name me one government illegal surveillance program that was shut down after the Snowden leaks.
Oh, they were expanded.
Uh-huh.
In fact, Snowden was made to look like the bad guy, which is something psychopaths usually do. You know, you get exposed and you make sure that, you have some, let's just say you have someone go out in the streets and they stab a horse or something that a policeman's riding or something like that. And then they blame the horse, you know, or, you know, any number of other things. People that are psychopathic tend to have these kinds of, oh, well, it's not my fault, it's theirs. And so when Edward Snowden released all the information, Julian Assange released information, suddenly the media apparatus was set into full gear to make sure that the public was told, these are the bad guys. These are the guys who are trying to hurt you. And unfortunately, I think the majority of Americans, if I can believe the polls, majority of Americans were actually believing that these were the bad guys.
Sounds about right. Well, it's the thing. It's a problem when you're using the truth. Now, people always go, oh, the truth will eventually come out, good will always triumph over evil, and all of these platitudes that just seem like weak-minded responses to problems that people don't fully understand yet.
Yeah, and also the majority of people, if you want to use the allegory of Plato's cave, only a small percentage of people will actually look for that truth anyway. So, yeah, there's the truths out there. I mean, you can go to various interviews on YouTube. You can go to various sources. You can go to all kinds of places and find the truth. And then when you try to tell someone this, they give you that kind of blank, cultic stare like, okay, but who's going to go to the Super Bowl this year? I mean, or is, you know, did you see the new pictures of Kim Kardashian?
Yeah.
This society, just like George Orwell did warn, has been, you know, celebrity gossip, beer, and sports.
Yeah. Well, if the truth shall set you free, explain Bradley Manning to me. Or now Chelsea Manning, you know. What was it like, on the fifth suicide attempt or something like that? Are you feeling that freedom, you Chelsea, you mm-hmm. know, when you tell the truth or whatever? No. I think these... What if those ideas, that being honest and being truthful and everything like that have inbuilt rewards into them were actually lies that were placed into society by psychopaths so that they could have an unfair advantage.
Because that then I haven't thought about it.
Because then all the chumps would just like, yes, I did it. Ha, I've got you now. Boom. And throw you away in my illegal black site prison. Boom, I got you. Make everybody else follow the rules, because the rules are for everybody else except me on a global level.
Well, if you think about this, I mean, I don't like to rip on religion too much, but I mean, our societies seem to do that anyway. But here's what's really interesting. Who are the heroes, for instance, in the Bible? We have heroes like, for instance, Noah. And if you read the story, he's someone who's totally defying the society. In my book, I present him as being a member of the elite who goes against the elite. You've got David, who, you know, goes against what everyone else is saying. You've got John the Baptist, you've got Jesus, you know, committing what, if you just want to put it in legal terms, insurrection. And yet, most churches will say, oh, follow what the government says, because that's what God wants you to do.
Thinking, Romans 13.
We just read about, you know, in Sunday school, we just read about this prophet or whatever who did this and defied the government. Okay, but no, that's not the way it is. It's, you know, we've got to follow all the rules. This actually started around World War I, where this indoctrination went into American religion.
Interestingly enough, what happened simultaneously at that point was it was the start of American public schooling, government-funded public schooling. And then immediately...
Yeah, well, you had lots of stuff. You had the Federal Reserve come in. You had the public schools, which... There was an element of people, reformers, who wanted to help poor people become, better, you know, learn more and stuff. But corporations and government wanted it in order to homogenize the culture, to make a more subservient culture.
They were using the outcome of the Franco-Prussian War as the example at the time, because Prussia at the time, which later became Germany, was resoundingly beat the French. And it was because Prussia had public schooling systems, so that when the war broke out, they were surprised. Just this huge wave of meat that wouldn't think for themselves, that would absolutely follow orders, that loved their country, signed up for the military immediately and rushed... Smiling at the enemy, and the French were just taken resoundingly. So,
but it's
therefore right after
that.
Well, so right after that, every other country then adopted public schooling, and then we've got World War I following that, and so on and so forth. We've got the whole of society laid out by that government program.
Right, but what's interesting was in World War II, it still had not worked that much because Americans had this very highly individualistic. Idealistic way of looking at life. And the Marshall studies found that 85% of men who were on the front lines did not fire their guns at an enemy soldier. Now, Hollywood will present it like, if you watch any of these movies, I don't know, Saving Private Ryan or something like this, the Americans are all gung-ho and they're rushing in and all that. That's not the way it was. If you look at the actual films of D-Day, many of those soldiers were just hiding behind the first object they could get around, you know, to protect themselves. That's when they brought in boot camp. And boot camp is not to get you in shape. It's to make you more, well, uniform. It's to make you follow the rules. It's to break your individuality and get you, you know, it's based totally on B.F. Skinner's views of stimulus response. They found that all of this training has caused soldiers to, instead of hesitating to shoot an enemy target, they just unleash. They just start pow, 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 pow. And the idea is afterwards they may feel guilty, but they're still alive. But this training has also, since 9/11, has gone into the American police forces, which of course has led to, you know, you've seen, now you can go on the YouTube and see many videos, stimulus response, guy gets out of car, teenager just reaching for his wallet saying, "Hey man," and he's on the floor dead, you know, on the ground dead, you know, and doesn't matter race, you know, a lot of times the media actually tries to make it look like a racial thing. And if you look, I mean, the police do this regardless. Well, because they've been trained.
Funnily enough, it's actually the people who are most often and more likely to be shot by police are actually white males. Mm-hmm. Something like an extra 50% more likelihood than it being shot by a black male. And it's like, whoa, that's interesting.
But the media has, if you notice, the media presents if there's a protest or something, you know, let's say a black man has been killed and you're going, wait a minute, he didn't deserve to die. He wasn't doing anything wrong. And then what they'll do is they won't show you the 1,000 people that are just with peaceful protest signs. They'll show you the 20 or so that are throwing stuff. And then that scares the people in the suburbs, like, oh my gosh, these people are going to come out here and start hurting me. So therefore, we need more police. Let them become more militarized. That's great, because look how they're behaving. In which, you know, the media, again, is giving, you know, what is that? It's from, it might be for, you know, your perception's your reality. And
solipsism.
The media knows how to play people. They know how to create this perception that keeps everyone angry at each other and everyone scared of one another. And therefore, we're willing to give up our rights. You know, oh my gosh, there's been this happening in England. We got to have internet surveillance and maybe close down extremist sites. Of course, when Theresa May says that, what is she defining? That's kind of a broad term. You know, what is an extremist site? I mean, under the laws they have already, if someone's getting on there inciting people to violence, like I suppose some of the ISIS or something would be doing, you can close those down anyway under the laws, I think, of every Western country. But instead, it's like, oh, something happened. Now we got to rethink all those freedoms that we have. And people will just buy into it because the media is what's telling them what to say and think and feel.
Well, and so is the movies to a large degree. You see many big Hollywood blockbusters nowadays that are basically just 90-minute commercials for the United States military.
Oh, what I'd like you to do, just a pause here, and that is, for all the listeners, because I didn't believe this when I heard it, and I did it, I checked it, type in to Google, type in CIA Entertainment Liaison. The only thing you have to do is type in CIA Entertainment Liaison, and you'll go to their site. It'll tell you. You do that, and you're going to find that they want to help you if you're a script writer or a book writer or something, and you're discussing things that have something to do with the CIA. And ever since World War II, the Pentagon and Hollywood have been really close to one another too.
Yeah, I just listened to the DVD commentaries of Michael Bay's Transformers, and they talked about how there's a lot of scenes within the film where the military would specifically tell them, no, you can't tell it that way. These are all the things that we want. These are the things that you can do, and these are your no-go areas. Like, they have complete and total control over how Hollywood represents the military. It was extraordinary.
Yeah, but what they get out of the deal is you get really good, you know, let's say you have some sort of movie where the aliens are attacking or something. You can get some really good stock movie clips.
Let me tell you what Michael Bay got. He got an aircraft carrier support battle group to change location from where they were in their normal operations and travel a couple of hundred miles to make it easier for them to do a helicopter round shoot of them. Okay? Mm-hmm. That's what they managed to do. And that didn't even cost them anything.
Yeah, think about how much that cost the American taxpayer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those things don't change position cheap. I mean, those things are pretty massive. They're huge. If you watch, I particularly notice if you watch TV program, and they, most people are not aware of this either, but it's true. You have, within entertainment, you have one set of entertainment that's designed for people that are just kind of regular TV junkie consumers. Those people that spend 5 hours a day, turn on the TV, like, what's on tonight, Marge? I don't know. Let's see. And they'll waste their evening just 5 hours of munching chips and watching whatever's on TV. And then, of course, you've got the more upscale people who they want something to escape. They want to watch TV programs that will allow them to live in a fantasy or something. And usually those are done in such a way that they leave you thinking afterwards. I'll use an example. I mean, you watch a TV series like Westworld. I don't know if you've seen that. Yeah. No, I mean, that leaves you. Well, it's kind of an introduction to the world of AI in the future, you know, when everyone's being able to live all their fantasies with robots that look and act just like humans. But that, if you watch the way the plot is rolled out and you watch listen to the dialogue, even the words used, pretty complex. So you know that's a highly educated population. But then you switch over to just regular TV, and it's like, who is watching this? I mean, you're thinking to yourself, who in the world? Well, obviously, lots of people are. And those are where you get your 30-minute, 60-minute, 90-minute commercials for, you know, I mean, I can't tell you how many TV shows I've seen where, you know, I'm just flipping the channel just once in a while, just like, oh my gosh, I just got to get my mind off some. And like the TSA, you know, the guys that feel you when you go through the airports, they're presented like these, you know, almost superheroes out to save the world. And like, what? I mean, but this, you're right. There is this propaganda machine that most people just kind of sit in their cave and look at the shadows on the wall. And if you try to pull them out, they're like, no, I'm comfortable.
Well, I think it's very interesting how you can really just blatantly lie to people, blatantly misrepresent yourself, and time after time, at least 30% of people will fall for it immediately. All right?
Oh, absolutely.
Now, that's what's absolutely interesting about American elections, because less than 30% of people even vote.
A lot don't vote because they just don't see the point. And the system likes it that way. I had a professor in a class of political psychology, and he actually said this. He was promoting this idea. He said, let's say you have a soccer game and your team's losing. You have this, do you really want people from the state, from the stadium to run out and start helping their team? And then, of course, the other team, everyone's going to run down there. It would be chaos. So he was promoting the idea that we need to have it where everyone feels involved. You know, they're there cheering and screaming and stuff. But you leave the playing to the people that are out on the field.
Yeah.
You know, very similar to Plato's Republic.
Well, he's treating it like it's a game. These are people's lives that we're actually talking about mm-hmm. that end as a direct result of people's voting choices. So, okay, so all Trump voters out there, how bad do you feel about all the Syrians who are now dead because Trump bombed them after you voted for them? Do you feel any responsibility? Because technically, you should. Everything he does is now your fault. That's going to make you feel good. We'll be back after the break, ladies and gentlemen. Donate at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Back in one moment, if you please.
Ladies and gentlemen, fellow slaves of the plantation, welcome to the Vinny Eastwood Show. It's Vinny with a Y because it's the most important question an Eastwood like go ahead, make my news. It's the lighter side of genocide. Just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? The Vinny Eastwood Show. For the only thing worse than the truth is Vinny's jokes.
Welcome back to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. Excuse me, something in my throat. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show on America. Fuck! Excuse me. On AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And my very special guest is Mike Cross. Mike, what is your website, please?
Oh, probably the quickest way you can just find it would be to type in MichaelCross/freedomfromconscience blog.
All right.
So that should take you there. I got articles on psychopathy, narcissism, brainwashing, and biotechnology.
But what's been happening recently is that there's been this move, I think, and I've been affected by it as well, in the truth community or people who want to get the truth out there about stuff, to start to fictionalize it so that people can ingest it maybe a little bit easier or be opened up to the ideas, you know. And that's what your book is about, isn't it?
Yeah, originally I had a book series. I have a book series out there anyway. It's about, ironically enough, a psychopath, but I present her as a heroine. That's the Freedom from Conscience series. You can look those up on my blog. But my most recent book is science fiction, and it's called The Destiny of Our Past. And in my opinion, this is a way that you reach people, because humans have always told tales around the campfire and that sort of thing. We shut off our cognitive level, as you talked about earlier, and stories reach our emotional level. And I've often noticed that people, especially more conservative or traditional or truther movement or any of these kinds of labels, they tend to look at things like, oh, here's a chart. Let me show you the facts. Let me deal with this happened, this happened, this happened in this way. And that is effective in reaching other people who are thinking in those ways. But if you want to grab onto some of the more non-traditional audiences and bring them in and get them thinking, I think it's a good idea to start doing fiction. I think people, when they read fiction, can see the outcomes of psychology or philosophy or things that are being worked on now. For instance, I'll give you an example from my book. You've seen articles that have talked about the fact that in the future our lifespans will be increased, right? I mean, you know, whether it's nanotechnology or genetic engineering.
Well,
you've seen it.
On that point, what's interesting is that we don't actually really have that much longer lifespans to what people did back in the day anyway. The difference was that a lot of people just died earlier back then because childbirth was dangerous, and like getting killed as a child by like a snake or whatever was a lot higher chance. And as a result, it just brought down the average of what the lifespan was. But the oldest of the old, they grow to be just as old as we are today. And it's just a common myth that we're all healthier today. If anything, we're worse off.
The only thing you'd be able to do is maybe extend life to our genetic potential if you were able to check all these other things. But now you have serious scientists talking about things like nanotech, you know, injecting computers into your body that would repair your telomeres and whatever in your cells at the cellular level. You got Ray Kurzweil talking about becoming, you know, being downloaded into machines, you know, that sort of thing. If anyone wants a good synopsis of the whole transhumanist movement, especially as it applies to AI, you should look up his documentary. He presents it. It's called Transcendent Man. I love at the end when he says, "I don't believe in God yet." Well, that shows you how these people feel. You know, because they feel that technology will bring them all of these benefits. In the future, though, you know, if you think about, well, what would that be like if we increase people's lifespan? What would that be? Well, what would that do for the government? Well, the government would then step in, as I have them do in my book, the government then starts to regulate fertility because they're like, oh no, we don't want the population to rise too fast. So now we're in charge of all fertility. And of course, you know, what you will do is you get sterilized at a young age, and then later you get a license, and then you can have children from your cells that have been put on ice. And lo and behold, I read an article, I think it was the Daily Mail, that a lot of women now, career women, they can't find the suitable men or something like that. So they are freezing their eggs just as an insurance policy that later, if they don't find Mr. Right when they're, you know, under 35 or 40, that they can unfreeze the eggs and, you know, start a family. We're starting to get into this kind of world that sounds science fiction, but I would say not science fiction in our traditional sense. We watch Star Trek. Everyone looks the same as we do now 300 years from now. No, all the tech wizards are saying, no, this is what's going to happen. Nanotech, biotech, artificial intelligence, it's going to change everything. And what ultimately you have to ask yourself is, how are the people that are in power now going to maintain power in this new system when these new technologies roll out? I think they'll be able to manipulate things in such a way that, for instance, when it comes to biotech, I think you've not seen eugenics at all until 20 or 30 years from now, when everything will be, we have to have the best kids ever, you know, and they'll have the technology to do it.
It'll be Gattaca.
Oh, it'll be beyond Gattaca. Gattaca, you still had traditional families, that sort of thing. It would be something that would be, well, like how I present it in my book, you know, that the family unit totally transforms. And then, you know, how that gets applied. I don't want to give up too much in the book. But the thing is, people, when they read that, they have like this reaction like, oh, my gosh, that's true. That's how things would change if this technology or this technology or this technology came about. As opposed to reading an article and they're like, okay, well, some scientist dude said this and I don't know. And, you know, that's kind of the end of that. And then you just have to wait for 20 or 30 years until it actually comes in. Fiction is something that more traditional people should really start trying to write. And here's the thing, though. The internet makes it possible to be able to reach more people because before – you know, you complain about the media, the big media being in charge of, you know, the word that gets out. Well, it's no different from books. The big publishing houses are what you will see talked about on those same news stations. Oh, the best-selling book right now is, and then people get the book and they look at it and they're like, this is boring, and they put it down after a chapter. I'm not going to name names, but there's been a bunch of books out recently. Then you're going, oh, how could, why are all the, you know, in this case, women going to go read this book? And then every woman I've talked to that read the book, they're like, this was really boring. I mean, you know, maybe I just know people that think that should have been more exciting, but the matrix, so to speak, that we can easily see in politics and media is also true when it comes to fiction and the books that we get there. Of course, there are small publishing houses that publish things too. But we really need – I think conservative or traditional people should really start looking into using their writing abilities. And I think we have a lot of creative people. It's – you know, think about some sort of bestseller about, I don't know, a CIA – I mean, maybe not a bestseller, but write a book about a CIA person that goes in thinking that they're going to save the world, and then they have to start training Al-Qaeda people or something in the Middle East, and how that's affecting, you know, the way they see life and how it's affecting, you know, their vision of reality.
One book that I would love to see done is a version of 9/11 from the perpetrator's perspective, like in the White House and the control rooms and things like that, and like and how they planned it and everything. Look, George, you're going to have to look stupid on this day, okay? You want to convince everybody that you're an idiot, all right? Hold the book upside down. Hold the fucking books upside down, all right? Come on. Don't you're reading in front of a children's class. They won't know it's upside down. Just do it, okay? People will think you're an idiot, but you couldn't possibly be behind this, all right? Okay.
All right, Dick. No problem.
It's just, it'll be fun.
Yeah, and the thing is, even if someone wants to do a graphic novel, that would be actually interesting. I don't have artistic abilities, or I would do graphic novels. But the idea,
some kind of Charlie Hebdo thing would happen immediately, though, wouldn't it?
You never know. But you know, that fiction stays in our mind. Lessons we have stick in our mind when we see a fictional presentation of it. And this is how we've changed society. I mean, if you look this up, your viewers can, you know, our listeners can look this up. Look up Brazilian birth rate soap opera influence, in which soap operas were used to show small families. This started like, you know, 20 years ago, show small families, have plots in which the woman doesn't want to get married when she's young. She wants to wait till she's in her 30s. She's got two possible husbands in the future. One of them's really traditional, wants to have a big family. The other one wants to have just a couple kids and live a nice suburban life. And of course, you make the guy that wants the bigger family into the villain, you know, and he's just a bad guy, you know, wears smelly shirts, that sort of thing. And this has had a huge influence. It's been credited with sending the Brazilian birth rate down now to around 2, when before it was really high compared to, you know, today. And this is what's effective about fiction. Think about how many people out there, oh my gosh, you know, you must know some of these people, and they'll watch a show on TV and they're saying, you know, let's say they're watching Walking Dead and they're going, why does Rick let those zombies almost get him all the time? I just wish I could just grab him. And you're like, wait a minute. It's a script. It's not real. But in their subconscious, it actually is. If you look at psychology, what we see on TV, our subconscious reacts the same way as if it was real.
I remember when I went in to see Prometheus in the theaters, and I'd heard that Alien, the original, had made people puke up in the theaters, run screaming from the screens. You know, things.
The scene where what was it? Hurt. He blows up. You know, all over this.
And I went into that film theater wanting to have a visceral experience like that, and I got exactly that when that surgery scene or whatever. I like literally passed out in my chair for a couple of seconds, and then came to, because it was so horrifying. Like, oh my god, that's and my heart started beating up. Thing, it had a really visceral effect. It was exactly what I wanted, and the reason why I wanted to open myself up to that is because I wanted to understand the power of filmmaking, okay? Because as far as I'm concerned, filmmaking is probably the most powerful art form that exists, because it incorporates all of the most powerful art forms that exist. It incorporates what you're seeing, what you're hearing, what you're feeling, what you're thinking, everything. Can be influenced by a very skilled filmmaker and script writer and a whole crew of people, and great emotions from the actors. You can literally change the way somebody sees the world by showing them a different world.
Yeah, and you know what's really quite fascinating to me, if you talk about societal manipulation, is American film now, they don't, or I'm going to deal with TV real quick, and that is, think about how they how the people in Hollywood, you know, and those people, you know, to those people, the whole country is flyover between New York and Hollywood, and how they present the average person. I mean, the average working Joe type person is presented as, at best, just a well-meaning moron. You know, they're really, They're shown in such a way that it's pathetic, and yet people watch this, and you know, you wonder, what, why would you do that? I mean, it would be like Christians, if, you know, again, in my book there is actually arena games. I base those more on the Roman games, but let's say the Romans had developed television. You know, they did actually have machines, but they just had so many slaves, they decided, whatever, they're cute, and they were toys. Yeah, but let's say they had gone a few steps further, and by 200 AD, they would have had televised sports. And it'd be like the Christians sitting there watching, oh, look, they're feeding Joseph to the lions today. Oh, wow. You know, I mean, and watching this as a spectator sport.
Live on ESPN, Joseph devoured by the lions, only for
$2.95. Yeah, actually, you must have read my book, because there's actually, you know, different channels you can get for different arena sports. But it's almost as if, you know, your slogan, the lighter side of genocide, a plot in my book actually is that the elite bloodlines, yes, it has some Illuminati aspects to it, the elite bloodlines want to eradicate the pretty much useless regular people. And, you know, how they go about it. And the regular people just kind of follow along and do it. And look at our society today. We have this, we have a system in which people are not getting married. They're not having children. They're weeding themselves out. And, you know, you sometimes wonder, is that have the elites looked and said, okay, well, soon robots will replace them. We don't need them anymore. So let's kind of create a society that is kind of non-conducive towards traditional, everyday mom, dad, kids type of thing. Well, if they aren't, it's certainly occurring on its own. So, and then, of course, you can look at some of these agendas, you know, like, how it's described in the future, like Global Trends 2030 and stuff like this. And you see what's, you know, there, it's these predictions. And we're just going right along. Now, whether they're planned, whether there's been a policy paper, I don't know. But it sure seems like there is. And they talk about these things as being positive. Well, we don't need these people. So, you know, we'll distract them.
It's public relations. And another word for public relations is PR, right? And another word is BS, right? Now, that's essentially, and people need to understand this, every time you see something being advertised to you, doesn't matter whether it's a good product, bad product, a good company, bad company, it's always not 100% the truth. It's always a perception of the truth, okay? At the very least, if not outright lies and complete distortions of reality in order to realign what your perception of reality is to their mode of thinking, including a dependency on their product, all right? Mm-hmm. They're working you like a machine. These people have done a lot of research. What was it, the Frankfurt School, I think it was, that came up with a lot of these ideas about how to influence people, suggestively, through the media and all of the other think tanks throughout society, have all got more or less the same goal and often more or less the same sponsors who are financing them that you can usually trace back to the same eight families.
Well, you know what's interesting? In my book, Destiny of Our Past, there's actually 13 major families and then subfamilies of each. But the interesting thing is that most people aren't aware of this, but there are psychologists and anthropologists whose job it is to even observe little kids. I mean, 3-year-old kids, 4-year-old kids, 5-year-old kids. Watch how they squeeze the toothpaste, how they interact with soap when they're taking a bath. These are studies that are conducted so that then you can redesign your soap, your toothpaste. It starts at a very young age. What's something, I talked to someone who has a master's degree in marketing just the other day. And we were talking about demographic groups, you know, how you split people up. And he said, oh, well, the one thing that marketers know is that young women, when they're first hitting puberty, become very self-conscious about their bodies because their bodies are changing very rapidly. Guys do too, but it's not quite in the same way. Okay. I mean, we don't have, unless, you know, talk about the what do you call those, skinny jeans. I hate those things. Yeah, looks like leggings. But, you know, women, their body is changing incredibly from 12 to 13 to 14. And so they become very self-conscious because they've got new bodies. So marketers know that this demographic group is very vulnerable to suggestion. So they spend an incredible amount of time reinforcing that they need to look perfect and then selling them the products to be perfect. So it's almost like when a farmer's feeding the chickens, you know, and you know that at some point they're either going to give you eggs or they're going to give you meat. And this is how the marketing works. And it's true for all of society. You've got people that are looking, well, except if you're like 90, I don't think they're really trying to sell you stuff when you're up in the upper levels. No insult to people over 90, but you know, it's not a group that's making a lot of major purchases. But those young groups, oh my gosh, you want to make sure that you're selling them on a dream. And in that sense, you're making them what you call wannabe narcissist. They're not narcissist, not initially. You know, you're looking at maybe 2% of the population that has a genetic predisposition towards narcissism, but you can still create, just like the secondary psychopath, you can create a wannabe narcissist.
Mm, and that's never more apparent than when you're looking on social media. You know, people always doing videos of themselves, always taking pictures of themselves, always giving their opinion and so on and so forth. You know, I've got the exact same traits as a narcissist, but I've decided that, you know, what's a better idea than just being it all about me is make sure that there's somebody else who's in the limelight with me while I'm providing the platform, because that way I feel that it requires the narcissism. It provides an ante, a counter to it. Now, that's because I've had consequences for my actions over the years. You know, when you hog the mic on stage or something like that, and the other musicians don't want to play with you anymore. These kind of things where you learn. You don't learn emotionally or empathetically, but through direct consequences. And I believe that part of the reason why society continues to get worse drastically is because people are incapable of providing very quick and resonating consequences for the narcissists and psychopaths that control society. When they do something wrong, do they get an immediate consequence? No, they don't.
No. I mean, think about, give you an example here. There's a lot of states in the United States where any possession of marijuana can get you a prison sentence. Okay. I mean, of course, we have a few states where it's legal, but most states, it's still illegal. You could face jail time. And if you don't face jail time, you're at least going to ruin your record. So if you want to, like, I don't know, you're 16 and you want to be a teacher someday, you know, you get caught with some pot. Well, now you got a felony conviction. Chances are you're not going to be, you know, a teacher when they got 100 applicants and they look at your application and say, oh, drug. He checked off drug possession at one time. But yet we look at movie stars where we joke about and almost idolize movie stars for, you know, oh, wow, you know how to use, use your cocaine and not show the effects. I mean, you know, they glamorize the movie stars using drugs. But then, you know, if it's your kid or my kid and they're using those same drugs, they're facing jail time. You know, so we have a double moral in, I think, all of Western society. You got a politician.
It's like a quadruple, because it goes back and forth as well, because these people get racked over the coals from time to time because of their drug usage and drinking and so on and so forth, and society is commanded to descend upon them like a pack of wolves.
Yeah, but then they get a movie part. Then they get a big movie part later, and everyone's like, "Oh, he and she's reformed now." See, they don't do jail time.
Exactly, they're playing both sides. We love an underdog, but we also love to kick someone when they're down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, well, that's part of the whole. What do they call it? I forgot the term for it. It's meaning the whole platform of entertainment. You know, it's kind of a, okay, this happens because this happens, and that's what the audience expects. So the audience expects a few things, like tabloid mag. I love tabloid mag. I don't love them, literally, but, you know, they say, oh, you get some movie actress who's reaching 40, you know, and then all of a sudden the paparazzi, they get some pictures of her topless playing volleyball in France on a beach. Well, what they don't tell you is in many of those cases, the agent has called the camera people saying, okay, we need to get a couple photos here on the beach and everything. And the consumer of these magazines are going, oh, they caught her. I can't believe, you know, that she would do that. But she's still looking pretty good for 40. And, you know, then she gets a leading role in the next movie. You know, it's a fiction that people seem to accept. Or, you know, you got a movie star, an actor who, you know, there's a rumor started. Oh, yeah, he's 55, but he's dating a 20-year-old. You know, what's his wife going to think? Well, they're all sitting around a table thinking, you know, planning this to make sure that he still is young enough to be able to be a leading man in the next movie. You know, it's all a fiction that people just accept and they don't question. Like, how come those are such good pictures? If it's just a cameraman, you know, you do photography, right? You've done some photography in your life.
Yeah.
So you know that it takes a lot to be able to get a perfect shot at a beach with the perfect light. You know, you're not going to just have your camera hidden under your, what, you know, your swimming trunks and pull it out and snap a picture.
Yeah. Well, my friend was at an event in Thailand and he met a photographer from National Geographic. And he said, and he asked him, so how many photos do you reckon you need to take in order to you get one for the magazine? And he goes, at least 1,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you need something that's going to look good. You need preparation. And yet people think, oh, wow, they caught him or her and all this kind of stuff. When I've seen, you know, when they set things out, I mean, you get these giant electrical units up with the lights and stuff like that. It takes a lot of preparation. You know, people need to ask their question, is that real or is it fake news? And, of course, you know, now fake news is a huge issue. But, you know, it's something people need to ask.
Mm. Well, so another thing that people really need to ask is that can we – oh, I think there's a little bit of an echo there is can we trust even the alternative media now? Because I was thinking about Operation Mockingbird the other day, how they bought off Walter Cronkite and got him to work for the CIA, literally selling fake news, the most trusted man in America. Why wouldn't they have done that to, you know, the so-called alternative media, the so-called truth movement and all of that kind of thing, disinformation agents? It's protocol.
I've wondered that at times, because you'll go to social media groups and if you try to post something that's something you create, you know, to give commentary, it won't get posted on some of these social media groups. But if it comes from one of these recognized alternative sources, then it does get posted. So, and some of these are not even really reputable. I mean, yes, there are fake news sites from both the right and the left. Usually it's pretty easy to spot them. If they have some sort of outlandish headline and it's not been reported anywhere else, then usually you should check it or something like that. Like, Donald Trump converts to Islam or something like that. Probably not real. But
it's clickbait.
But those get, yeah, the clickbait. Oh, by the way, a clickbait, that's horrendous. I posted something in social media the other day saying, if you really want to hurt these, you know, I won't name them. If you really want to hurt these media sources, don't click on the links, because when you do, it generates revenue for them. And I had people saying, well, why don't you click on the links? I don't understand. Because when you click on a link to any news source, they can show that to their advertisers and say, look, I wrote this story about, I don't know, Donald Trump sacrificed a baby on top of Mount St. Helens the other day, and I got 3 million clicks. And the advertiser is going, I don't care if it's accurate or not, you know, that's 3 million traffic. So therefore, they have to pay more money for the advertiser.
Well, it's internet trafficking, isn't it? You know, not entirely dissimilar from human trafficking, drug trafficking, or other forms of trafficking. It's just trafficking in bullshit, which is another commodity.
Well, the thing is, we still have to have a certain amount of trust and faith in alternative media. I mean, I just think that we need to get more people involved. We need more people writing, like you said, writing fiction. We need to get people doing webcast. We need to, you know, we need to get people doing blogging and stuff. And it seems a lot of people just get lazy and like, oh, I saw this here and yeah, I'm going to share it. And they don't write anything themselves. And everyone has the ability. I've seen some videos that actually have 30,000 views where a guy's just sitting in a car with a webcam and he's just like, well, here's how I feel about this. You know, I mean, this is a power we have. We need to use it before, you know, we get the Theresa Mays and people like that, you know, restricting it and saying, oh, that guy sitting in the car, he's, I don't know if we should trust him or not.
If you allow somebody else to control the flow of information, that's a really, really bad direction to be going down, you know. Kind of like having a paranoid surveillance of everybody. Well, if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear. Thank you, Joseph Goebbels. Jawohl! And it's like, when you hear the New Zealand Prime Minister and simultaneous head of the GCSB, our equivalent of the NSA, saying, oh, well, you know, if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear. It's like, are you literally quoting Nazi propaganda to me, bro, as a way of passing your Nazi agenda through? Right. People haven't seen stuff before, so they have no idea what's playing out in front of them. And this is the reason why fiction is so good as a tool to illustrate reality for somebody. Like one of the realities of the fight against the New World Order in general that I like to tell through story is the parable of the fight between the tortoise and the hare. Now, the tortoise is actually, when he's carrying a hammer, is a symbol for socialism. What was it? Fabian socialism. Moves very, very slowly and then strikes the hammer blow. Fabian socialism, otherwise known as the wolf in sheep's clothing socialism, which is their other symbol, versus the hare. Now, the hare is overconfident. He's lazy. He's sitting under the tree and he's sleeping in the middle of a race against this tortoise because he thinks the tortoise is so slow that he can just take it easy. And then he wakes up and he's late and the tortoise is very, very near the finish line. The New World Order is almost complete. And here we are, humanity, suddenly woken up under the shady tree and are running towards the finish line. And it's just a question who actually gets there first. Because we can run really fast. We can create new things very, very quickly. Movements can rise and fall in matters of weeks, days and months. And can lay waste to hundreds, if not thousands, of years of planning, right? That's the question that I think people
We see that in much of family. I mean, people in Western society today, I mean, think about how many sacrifices went into making each and every one of us. You know, we have ancestors who faced plagues and nasty kings and revolutions and invasions, and they still sacrificed to get us here, so we're like, oh, well, I'm just going to have a dog or a cat, and I'm going to skip having kids, and I'm just going to live it up. And then they die lonely. I mean, but yet all of that culture that they had passed down through their family is also dead. I was walking through, oh, get this, just to make a point about this when you said the civilization going. I was walking through a secondhand store the other day. And I was just glancing at some of the stuff and everything. And I noticed a lot of really nice china. I mean, the kind that, you know, usually is pretty expensive. The kind that, you know, you just don't drop it when you go to a family reunion because it's been going around for a lot of years. And I noticed a lot of this china, and I was starting to put a story behind it. Like somewhere there's like these older people who are dying without families, without any anyone to pass this on to. And then whatever government agency comes in afterwards, a real estate agency, they're like, okay, well, we need to, you know, just send this to the secondhand store. and get rid of it. So all those memories and all the stuff about them, you know, anything that they would have had involved in it, it's gone. There's no one to pass it to. And my personal opinion is this is actually something that could be, I said before, it could be part of a plan to depopulate, because they figure, oh, we'll have the really poor people that'll do these jobs. The middle class we can phase out. They're problematic anyway. They question things. We can replace them with robots, and then we'll have the elite. And so you get rid of, you just, but you persuade them. It's a genocide that doesn't require pits and guns and gas chambers. It's just basically a genocide that just keep them from reproducing until they're about 40 and your job's done.
The word is democide, when a population gets exterminated by someone they elected to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. The policies we see in Western culture seem to be, you know, very much designed to get people not to have that kind of 1960s alternative, at least. And if you do question the society, it's very difficult then to have the same economic levels. Yeah, sure, you can move out to some remote area of Alaska and live the way you want to, but your lifestyle is going to be very much affected by it. So that dream of the nice home when you're like, you know, you get married, I don't know, you got husband and wife, 25 years old, they move into their first starter home. Those starter homes now cost a fortune. So if they want to live in the big city where the jobs are, they can't. They have to move out somewhere else. Many of them decide go to the city. And I've talked to many people that say, like, nice neighborhoods of San Francisco, for instance, or New York, you don't see children. It's like all these upper class educated people, and they just decide, yeah, reproduction, you know, whatever.
Mate, that reminds me of what people are now actually being forced to do as a result of the conglomeration of New World Order influences on their lives. Mm-hmm. Me and my mate were traveling somewhere, and I think it was about 4 o'clock in the morning. We decided to leave early, right? And traveling south from Auckland. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, it was gridlock from people traveling hundreds of kilometers north because they couldn't afford to live in the city to work. Right? Mm. Gridlock at 4 o'clock in the morning. Good morning. It floored me, bro. I nearly burst into tears to think that this is what my countrymen are having to do every day. They're having to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to have a shower and have a coffee and maybe if they're lucky, get some breakfast into them to get stuck in traffic until about 9 o'clock in the morning when they have to start work, and then be stuck in traffic on the way home until maybe about 9 o'clock at night. And then they can't do anything. They can't hang out with their kids. They can't have dinner with their family. They just have to quickly go to bed so that they can have enough sleep just to get up tomorrow morning to repeat the process. This is killing people.
Yeah, but the difference is, if they live in the city, what they spent to get that, you know, 3 or 4 bedroom home where they can actually raise a family, they would maybe be able to afford a studio apartment in the big cities.
Yeah.
Which would basically mean, and you know, if we're looking at this whole biotechnology thing and all that stuff, I still think you hear right now talking about guaranteed incomes. You know, because, well, we're going to replace all these jobs, so maybe we need a guaranteed income. Do you really think they're going to give people enough money that they can have the 3-bedroom home out in the country and raise their family and the dog and the cat and, you know, the swing set and all that kind of stuff? No, they would give you a guaranteed income that you could afford a nice little studio apartment with your AI and your, sex robot or whatever, and you know, you'll just quietly and nicely live your life and be satisfied with this kind of existence, and then you'll just kind of pass on. I mean, that I think that is the plan. I personally think it's the plan.
Yeah, a easily recyclable human population that's very small and manageable, and AI will surveil everybody. and red flag anybody who might be logged as a potential threat, you won't have any rights, so they can just kidnap you off the street or execute you in broad daylight, you know. And other people that are around you, you'd ask them for help and they'd just keep walking because they know that if they help you, their chip would be turned off and they wouldn't be able to buy food or go get into their apartment and they'd just die on the street like you.
Well, I see people don't ask that question. You know, they hear about the guaranteed income and they think, oh, well, this could be really good. It'll help all these people that are going to lose their jobs through automation. But they don't understand who is going to be their employer. It's going to be the government giving them their you know, downloading their money supply into whatever system, you know, AI chip or something like that. And, you know, then if you do become problematic, they could just shut off the chip. You know, well, guess you can't buy anything anymore. I mean, this could be very easy. See, I mean, the opportunities for fiction here are remarkable.
The thing that people don't think about is as they go, oh, I'll just go to my friends and everything. Yeah, but they're on a fixed income too. And their fixed income is only enough so that they can support the food that they need to eat to get their daily nutritional requirements so that when you go for them to help to get a handout, you can't get anything.
Or I've read stuff that seems to indicate this, that the family model of the future will actually be polyamorous, in which maybe you'll have a situation where a woman will have an apartment, but it may be only big enough for maybe having one kid. And so therefore they, you know, because guys will have their sex robots and stuff like this. And so therefore women will form, you see this in ghettos where, you know, not in the sexual aspect, but the, you know, women will get together in areas where there's not a lot of children born with fathers in the home. They form social support networks. And you're starting to see this already with women in their 30s, like, okay, well, I'll get together with her and her and we'll get, you know, sperm donation. And then they raise their kids that way. I think this could be that's one of the things that will lead to kind of this eugenic thing that will come into the future. And that's where families will not look exactly like they do now. No, maybe it's like that the Bible says, you know, there'll be seven women to every one man. You know, that, and it's not necessarily a war that will cause this because men are more likely to think, oh my gosh, I got this robot that looks like, I don't know which movie star they like. I've got my AI system. I've got my guaranteed income. I'm set. I don't mind. Women still have this kind of maternal thing going where most of them actually do want at least a child. And, you know, so under this system, then it'll, each generation will become smaller and smaller and smaller. I mean, I foresee a time when maybe some of our big cities we see today will return back to nature. I mean, at least that's the goal of these, a lot of these people that talk about massive population curtailment.
Now, this is why I don't know if I'm fascinated. I don't know if I'm perplexed or if I just completely understand it. Right, when faced with this information, and I'm talking to the listeners here, when you're doing your job every day and you're living your life, when you go, okay, there's a very concerted effort to enslave, control, and exterminate me, what am I going to do about it? And you continue to go to your job, right? I had that. Mm-hmm. I had that question myself, and it's a deeply personal thing. You know, I'm not knocking anybody. Everybody's got their own situation, and it's discourteous and arrogant to judge other people's situations, where they are in their headspace and their life. Are they able to make this decision? But for me, it was a pure survival instinct thing. You know, and I really don't like being told what to do. Been told what to do for a long period of time, and most of the people who were telling me what to do were telling me to do things that were stupid or pointless, you know. And so I stopped going to work, I stopped doing all of that stuff, and I dedicated myself 100% to resisting that system that will eventually kill us all, right? Because the thing about eugenics is that it's an enclosed system. And what happens when you've got animals within an enclosed breeding system, they wind up breeding themselves into extinction. Okay. And that's the real difficulty here when you think about how they're actually trying to achieve these low birth rates and so on and so forth, is they're just putting chemicals into the water, you know, like fluoride is a badly will affect anybody's fertility if they drink fluoridated water. And it seems to me like the consequence of that is eventually you'll actually run out of the capacity to keep the human race alive by biological means alone. And I think that's what they're planning, is the human race will die and end unless you give us control. When they're the ones who are killing us, they're the ones who are ending humanity. Because when you're talking about humanity, it is a free humanity that you must be talking about. Because what's the point of being human if you're not free? Mm.
Yeah, I think even if we don't even talk about the whole thing about estrogen mimickers and stuff like this and the plastics and, water runoff from cities, the mere fact that people are not moving anymore, they're not getting exercise, well, that really does affect fertility. I mean, if it reduces testosterone levels in both males and females, if a male doesn't actually do things that he feels like he's winning at something, you know, if he's just kind of going along to get along, avoids any kind of harass, you know, doesn't want to harass anyone, doesn't exercise, his sperm count's going to go down because his testosterone's going to go down, and he will become more docile because of that. Put on weight, which means the testosterone goes down because the weight causes it counteracts testosterone. And I'm kind of seeing this where there's more and more males that are infertile. And I was reading this article about this guy. I mean, he has like a Facebook page from England. I don't know if you heard about it. He has like 800 children that he's created. And I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. There has to be a demand for there to be a supply of women going in and saying, hey, you know, I want a baby. Because if you think about it, if let's just say, just pretend like each of those women, you know, he's gotten two. Let's just say 400 of them have two kids from him. He's replaced 400 men in, you know, overall. And it's just that, why? I mean, are there more men that are sterile? Are there more men that are just kind of going, eh, who cares, you know?
Boys have a different a different chemistry. So a lot of chemicals actually affect men a lot more than they do women.
Mm-hmm.
For example, autism is now 80% boys. Only 20% of girls become autistic after they have a bad vaccine reaction. So the boys are a lot more susceptible.
Yeah, I think we may see a situation where, if we're talking about this eugenic thing, it could just be the guys that are healthy enough not to be affected by the environment that wind up becoming the donors that keep the families going in the first place.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's spermicidal musical chairs.
It could be. I mean, I know a guy that, you know, I know a guy actually who went in and donated, and, you know, he said the nurses were like, oh, wow, you know, you're a real healthy person. Yay, you're great. And all this kind of stuff, because he joked around with them and stuff. Then he flirted with the nurses. But, you know, I think they said that they expected he'd get around 8 to 10 kids because they limited the number of children that he could create. But they're, he's replacing several men who will have no children. And why are they not having children? You got to ask the question, is it because they don't want to or they can't? And then you have to ask the question, why couldn't they if they wanted them, but they couldn't do it? And then a lot of that, I think, has to do with the environment of today's society.
which was created in the 60s by the CIA and Freemasonry and the rock culture and acid culture and all of that kind of stuff to destroy the family unit, to degrade people's society, and also to distract people that were in their early 20s and their 30s and things like that, which are the prime earning and prime creativity decades in your life, to spend that partying and expanding your consciousness with drugs instead of actually earning money and becoming a more powerful and influential member of society. And thus, a lot of the people that had a lot of potential to really influence society in a positive way were instead influenced by society to have no power to change it.
Yeah, they were distracted and led a different path. Many of them, I've talked to many people in their 40s and 50s who say, my gosh, I really wish I could go back and do things different. But the thing is, you can't. So, you know, they're left with these regrets. Many times it is women saying that, gosh, I wish I'd had kids. I really wish I'd had children. But I bought into this. I got to do this and this and this and this and this. And, you know, the biology just passed them by.
Carrot on a stick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we never get the rewards for the things that we're promised, and we never paid what we're worth.
Yeah, but I think it's going to get more and more the case as we see, again, artificial intelligence and these kinds of things taking more and more jobs. But in that sense, I hate leaving things on like a downer, because I do think that if we do create, we can create our own sustainable communities. Now, I'm not. Some people say if you use the word sustainability, that you're probably part of some sort of plot.
Agenda 21.
Yeah, but when you hear a government official say it, that's different. But I would say sustainability should be something where we get to the idea that we form communities again. We're not communities anymore. It's a. If you read about the way that some of the policies in Northern Europe, in the Scandinavian countries. They pushed this idea of individuality, but it wasn't the individuality you and I in an Anglo-Saxon country would understand. It was the individuality of being broken away from all of the constraints, family, religion, fraternal societies, those kinds of things. And what you do is you have an autonomous individual who's easier to control. And what we need to do is make sure that we resist that. We become part of societies that are actually working to help one another, to educate one another, to find, you know, ways to afford, you know, how to be able to afford things. And I think this is a way that we can resist, because ultimately you can't just, I see the situation, so I'm just going to go hide in a cave and wait for it to happen, because they want you to hide in a cave and wait for it to happen. That's as good as putting you into that cubicle apartment and giving you your guaranteed income and your sex robot.
Yeah, because you offer them no resistance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would actually say that, you know, you look at these, you do have communities where people do pretty well. You know, still maintain middle class incomes, but they have to adapt to the situation. But they also have to be knowledgeable about what's going on. If they're knowledgeable, then that gives them the incentive to fight back.
Thank you very much, Michael Cross, for joining me today on the auspicious episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of a genocide. Just because we're slaves and have a plan to be subsequently exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point? And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. I really do hope and pray that you go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and hit up that Patreon, the PayPal, and if you are in New Zealand, starting up an automatic payment into the Kiwi Bank account really, really does help out in the daily cost of simply surviving. And that's all I have to do in order to keep doing this job, because this job is about survival. Understand me. Thanks very much, Michael. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. And thank you, American Freedom Radio, for giving us all on this network the platform. Catch you later.